metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. When we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence of Prince, John Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour. And I want to point out to those of you who haven't looked at a calendar recently, it is January the 30th on the West Coast, and the early morning hours of January the 31st on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. So nice to have you with us this evening. This is the last show of this month, and got some great guests lined up for next month, all throughout the month. So you want to be sure to check out the schedule. It's not posted on my DirectLightProductions.com website yet, but it will be. I have been very, very busy lately, and had a chance to look at my email, and there's just a ton of email. And I want to applaud everybody who's doing follow-up research. It's obvious that you're doing this because I have piqued your interest in identifying who some certain characters are in the political arena, and people are starting to discern what's going on, and they're finding some really interesting stuff. So I want to thank everyone who sent me an email. Too many to mention. I've gotten hundreds of them. One particular individual sent me 41. So you can imagine that people are busy, and I appreciate your steadfast determination to help get some of this information out. We will be sharing it with the public. I haven't even had a chance to look at some of the documents that I received, but I can assure you, listeners, that it'll be, it's going to contribute to some good radio. Let's put it that way. Hopefully some good journalism as well. So my thanks to the listening audience and to the visitors at my website. Well, we come to the time now where I have to introduce my guest. I don't have to, but I do that because it's nice to know who's on the show, in case you haven't looked at the schedule. This gentleman has been with me every week since I've been on the air. I mention this every week. We always have some new listeners, so if you're wondering who he is, well, he is a scientist, he is an inventor, an author, a lecturer, and a teacher, and his name is Jim Murray. He's also our resident science advisor and my co-host on Friday nights. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints again.
Well, thank you, Don. I always enjoy being here with you.
Well, I know you do, and that's because you have a chance to share with the listening audience a lot of unusual and very unorthodox science, as well as just a wealth of information that you have from all the other interests that you have, which really even go beyond science, per se. And we always look forward to what you bring to the show. I know we've been beating this drum of the politicians and the politics and all of the stuff that's going on behind the scenes that I write about or I research, and I appreciate your involvement in that and want to recognize that you are a scientist, that you are an inventor, and you have interests in things that usually are suppressed. And I know you brought a new topic to the table tonight for us to discuss. And so I'm going to turn the mic over to you and allow you to share that. And feel free to have me interrupt any time. How's that?
Okay, I will feel free to have you interrupt at any time.
Okay.
And, of course, I appreciate the point of view and the candor that you bring to the things we discuss also. You know that.
Yes, I do.
But anyway, I thought an interesting change of pace might be to talk about something which I find to be a fascinating line of discussion, even though I'm not an expert in the field. It's something which has held my interest for many years. And for lack of a better description of what this subject entails, I will just use the same title that has been used since the time of the conquistadors, and that is the Seven Cities of El Dorado. And this is a real strange grouping of tales because it involves such a huge landmass that it's difficult to even get a hook into where this place is supposed to be. But I learned a very interesting lesson when I was in South America a number of years ago, and then later on I found out that other explorers had heard similar things and led them to the same conclusion. And that is that the native peoples have a tendency of exaggerating, whether by design or just by their very nature, the position of something that you're asked for them to describe. So if you're in South America, let's say you're down in southern Brazil, and somebody asks you, where is this particular location? They'll probably point north and say, oh, it's in that direction. The interesting thing is that that process continues all the way from southern Brazil right up into the United States. And then if you ask Native Americans in the United States about something, they'll point south and say, oh, it's in that direction. And the same process works for east and west. And there isn't any particular mileage associated with the statement, oh, it's in that direction. So this has a terrible tendency of leading people on, sometimes to their absolute demise if they're insistent enough in following the directions.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Fossett used this method, though, to bracket the approximate location of areas that he wished to explore. And what he did was he explored from the south, then he explored from the north, then from the east, and then from the west. And by asking thousands of tribes or thousands of individuals from different tribes the same questions, he was able to get a general area where he ultimately tried to explore and naturally disappeared. So the reason I bring all this up is because El Dorado, if it exists, has been reported in every imaginable location from New Mexico all the way to Chile. And so it's not exactly something we can get a hook into. But The fact that its existence is apparently persistent in the scheme of things and appears over and over again in legends, the question arises, well, do you think it could exist? And if it did, you know, where and when? And those are questions that oftentimes, you know, get ignored. Now, my personal feeling is that if such places exist, they are probably in South America. The reason I say that is that South America is the one continent that has so little changed since, you know, recorded history began that it could hide any number of things, and never even be suspected that they're in there. First of all, Brazil alone is two-thirds the size of the United States, and most people don't even have a feel for that. So we're talking about an ungodly territory, totally vast, and the only thing that's really been explored are the edges of the rivers or the banks of various rivers. In a lot of areas, there's just been no penetration from especially from white folks. And in modern times, nobody bothers to do that anymore. Back in the 1920s, they were still trying to establish borders, and they were still looking for precious gems and minerals and oil deposits and things of that sort. So there was a lot of activity down there. And, of course, back in the time of the conquest of South America, the conquistadors were running around all over the place, and they penetrated into some really unknown areas. But they never found any of these lost cities. So my feeling is that if they exist, they are extremely old. And when I say extremely old, I'm going back, in my mind, probably 10,000 years or more, into the area of time that can only be represented by the previous epoch, which would be the end of the last ice age. And obviously they existed before that as well, but I'm just trying to bracket a time scale. And the reason that I think that they were in South America in this time period is because we do have some measuring sticks. There are some very, very ancient structures in South America which have been attributed to the Incas, although the Incas themselves are the first to tell us that they were there before they were. Tiwanaku is one, and Puna Puna is another. And some of these civilizations, which were not in the jungles but in the mountainous areas, go back to the time when the Andes were actually a lot less mountainous than they are now. And the reason that we know this is there's every indication that Tiwanaku was originally designed as a seaport. And now it sits at about 17,000 feet above sea level. And obviously it can't be a seaport in modern times. So we're talking about a time period before the last raising of the Andes, Don. That's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned that, you know, when people were asking for directions to this area, what came to mind is it was probably somewhere in the middle of what you were describing, and I'm sort of saying that tongue in cheek. Obviously, if there is gold, they're not going to identify where this place is. In fact, the dictionaries refer to it as a fictitious place, and they say that it is thought to or believed to exist somewhere in the region of the Orinoco and Amazon rivers. And I suppose they say that so that if somebody goes there looking for gold, they might encounter an anaconda. You know, so there's always obfuscation when gold is at stake, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, but you know, I can't take credit for this little anecdote that I'm about to relate personally, because I obviously haven't been wandering around the Orinoco Valley lately. But
mm-hmm.
I had a very dear friend years ago by the name of John Steele. And John, I met him in northern Michigan. And interestingly enough, he had been a bush pilot in South America and in Central America. And he had the opportunity over the course of his career to meet up with a lot of indigenous natives. And he knew that the native population was very aware of the white man's lust for gold. And so he had a very, very different attitude about dealing with it than the average gringo would have. And as a result of that, not only did he save his skin, on a number of occasions, but he learned a lot more than most people do. And the natives are always testing to find out what kind of a individual they're dealing with. So he would be landing his plane in some out-of-the-way place and delivering something or picking up something or whatever he was doing down there. And in the time that he stayed with the peoples of this area, he tried to learn as much as he could. And the one story he told me, which I thought was fascinating, was that he accompanied a group on a hunting trip coming out of one of these remote villages. And they went up into an area which was very mountainous and had a lot of streams. And these streams, you know, form tunnels, which is often the reason why they're followed, is because the vegetation is so dense that it's actually easier to walk in the water and, you know, go to a certain place than it is to sometimes trek through the underbrush. And they were in one of these grottos formed by position of the stream and the overhanging vegetation. And they sat down to have something to eat on a series of flat rocks. And this one native reached down into a pool of water and pulled out a gold nugget that was, according to John, was the size of an egg. And he tossed it to John and asked him what he thought about it. At least that's the impression that he got, that he wanted to know what he thought about it. And John just was absolutely blasé. He looked it over. In his own mind, he realized from the weight of it and the size of it that he was actually holding a fortune in his hand already. And he just tossed it back to the native and said, "Very pretty, very, very pretty," and acted as if he couldn't care less. And so after a few experiences like that, they realized that he wasn't the type of person who was out to seek wealth at any cost, and they began to tell him different things. And after 20 or 30 years of that type of stuff, he had an amazing wealth of information, and he had obtained it without losing his, you know, without losing his head, which is a very likely possibility in some of those regions, even today.
Mm-hmm. Of course, these days you can lose your head at just about anywhere on the planet, so, but I understand what you're saying.
Well, there's different ways of losing it, and perhaps that's the idea, you know.
Yeah. So, he gained their trust. Now, was he also putting away a stash of these eggs, or or he just remained disinterested?
No, actually what he did was, he wouldn't have dared try that because it would have been too obvious. You have to realize that the people who live in these environments, they are using, and this has literally been proven, they are using about 95% of their brain just to stay alive. And in contrast to that, a person sitting watching a football game on television is using between 3 and 5% of his brain. So what I'm trying to get at is due to the circumstances under which these folks live, their awareness is probably 90 times greater than what the average American is capable of experiencing. They don't miss a thing. I mean, from a tick being on, you know, on somebody else's shoulder or clothing, to the presence of virtually up to several different animals, you know, in the surrounding woods simultaneously. I mean, they're aware of everything. And for him to try and smuggle stuff out or even stop to pick something up after he'd apparently discarded it would not go unnoticed. So basically what he did was he just made mental notes, and then when he got back to civilization or back to the village where his plane was, he would sit and update his journal. And I always wished that he had left me that journal when he passed away, but apparently it went on to somebody else, or else it was thrown away, which would be a shame. But I never got to see it. I just got to hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, who did you hear it from? That is it?
I knew the man himself.
Okay.
I knew John Steele personally. As a matter of fact, he had a rather unusual story in general anyway. He, when I met him, he was probably 70 years old. And, he had come up to, northern Michigan, several times during the course of his earlier years, simply because he enjoyed the area. It's such a contrast from the jungles of Central and South America. So when he retired, he always felt that that would be a nice place to go to. And somewhere in his later years, he went in for a physical checkup and found out that he had stomach cancer. And so he figured, well, if I'm going to cash in, I'm not going to do it in South America. So he bought a little house up in northern Michigan in the same town where I was for many years, when I was working for Bethlehem Steel. And during that time period, the cancer completely regressed. And so he lived another 20 years. As a matter of fact, he was going strong long after I left. So he was a very real guy, and he had a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very likable fellow. And he's one of the reasons why I had an interest in this, all this stuff, was because of things that he told me. And, of course, later on I met other people in my personal travels who, you know, heavily accented some of the things that he had told me. But one of the most interesting stories that seems to lend a lot of proof to the existence of these lost cities was the journal that did come out of the wilderness of a fellow by the name of Rasposo. And Rasposo was a guy who started off being shipwrecked during the time that the Portuguese were involved in the exploration of Brazil, which would have been in the 1400s sometime. I don't know the exact date. But he wound up being shipwrecked there, and then he got involved with a local group that was actually interested in some of these Indian legends concerning these cities. And he joined up with an expedition to go into the interior of Brazil. And they were gone for literally 4 or 5 years. And only God knows what kind of an experience that was for that group, because in the 1400s, this place was as primeval as you can ever imagine. And to survive that long and make it back out in that time period must have been an unbelievable trial. But what happened was, after many years of wandering, they had nothing, hardly anything left, including their clothes, which have a tendency to rot right off your back in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for food one day, and that means anything that moves, you know. When you're living off of the land itself, you don't have a whole lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
And they came into a small clearing, and there was a deer grazing there. And they went to sneak up on it and try to take a pot shot at it, or whatever they were doing with it. I guess they had very primitive muskets back then. Naturally, as soon as they cocked their muskets, the thing took off. And so they chased it around the base of this huge cliff, and it just seemed to disappear. And while they were trying to root it out, they discovered a grotto that was all overgrown. And it turned out that this grotto was a passageway that led up the face of this escarpment where they had been camped. And so it looked as if there were an ancient set of staircases carved into the rock, actually going from ground level up through this cliff face, leading toward the top. And so since they had explored around the base of the whole thing, just in an effort to find a way out of that valley they were in, they decided that maybe they'd learn more by getting to the top of this thing. If nothing else, they could see where they were. So they went up these stairs, and they came out onto a plateau that was quite extensive. And in the distance, they saw a huge city. And their first impulse was, to drop down rather than be seen by the occupants. So they camped there all night long, and during the night they didn't see any lights or any fires or anything that would give indication that it was inhabited. So the next morning they hiked over to the actual ruins. And they described them as being absolutely massive, all built with monolithic stones of huge size and covered with hieroglyphs that they didn't recognize at all. And so they made copies of these hieroglyphic writings. And they entered the city, and there was a big plaza in the middle of this city, and there was a statue there, and it was apparently a statue of a youth that was clad in unusual clothing, and he was pointing in a direction which they interpreted to be north. And the city was massive, but it was completely in ruins, and there were sections where the ground had opened up and swallowed entire buildings. And they could look down into these crevasses and actually see, building stones and artifacts down in there. So they knew that the place had been destroyed as a result of volcanic activity. And they spent 2 or 3 days exploring that area, and then they moved on and found a stream to follow, or a riverlet. And that eventually brought them out onto a river that was quite sizable. And they built a raft and went down that river and wound up in the area of Salvador, Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they did find one artifact of interest, which was a gold coin. And the description of this coin has been studied many, many times in modern times, as have been the hieroglyphs that they copied. And the hieroglyphs are similar they're much older than Greek, but they're more similar to Phoenician, a very ancient form of Phoenician. And the gold coin, which could have been from a later period, was likened to a drachma, which is quite old in its own right. And this is just one of hundreds of stories that come out of these areas.
Yeah. Now, were they able to, let's say, estimate what time period this civilization actually existed?
The only thing that they said was that it had to have been extremely ancient because of the style of the architecture, the size of the stones, and the fact that there was absolutely nothing left of anything like furniture or human artifacts or anything of that sort. They didn't even find bones, which you would think if a city of that sort had been destroyed by a volcano or an earthquake, that there would be human remains. But you got to figure, if it's true that happened, let's say, 10,000 years ago, when there were huge upheavals in that continent, nothing would really be left. And so that was exactly the case. There was no furniture, no human artifacts that they could detect, and the only thing they did find was a metal coin.
And the hieroglyphics that you mentioned, too, right?
Right. Well, of course, they were etched in the stone, so they're going to be there for a while.
Yeah. Interesting. So did they ever determine who those people might have been? I mean, you sort of hinted along that line, but you didn't really...
Well, I don't know that there's any actual knowledge of who they might have been, but it's pretty obvious that the history of our Earth is different from the way it's perceived.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we do know, though, the Phoenicians were all over South America, especially Brazil. And they have even found the remains of shipyards where ships were built. I don't know what the date would have been, but it would certainly have been many years before the arrival of the conquistadors. And they have found complete histories of expeditions carved in stone down there that were readable in ancient Phoenician. And there's also, I think it's in Rio de Janeiro, there's a mountain, the top of which had been sculpted into a helmet-clad head. And there are similar hieroglyphs on that, which indicated as a tomb, that it had been prepared as a tomb for some leader of one of these Phoenician expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's long since been razed. There are no contents in the interior of this massive head. And interestingly enough, the entranceway was through one of the ears. There was actually a tunnel in one of the ears that led into the interior, which had been hollowed out, but much like a sanctuary or a tomb would be.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of indications that South America has more than what we attribute it to be in terms of linear history.
Now, Jim, was there any attempt made to decipher the hieroglyphics, or did they just assume that that was too much of a task?
Well, I don't think anybody tried to... determine what they were in that time period. But I can tell you from my personal involvements with Jean Savoy that mm-hmm. in recent times that work has been undertaken. There were several explorers that, in modern times that went down through that area looking for remnants of old civilizations. The three modern ones that I'm aware of, and I'm sure there were more, is Colonel Fossett, who we've talked about on other shows,
mm-hmm.
Leonard Clark, who was an adventurer and wrote a book of great renown called The Rivers Ran East. He spent a lot of time trudging around in the wilderness down there, and it's remarkable that he came out alive because he went in so ill-prepared that he even questioned his own folly. And then there was Jean Savoy, who was a friend of mine, a personal friend of mine. And we did a commemorative show on Jean about a year ago. He only passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
But he discovered on his own, without the sanction of any foundation or any academic group, 11 cities, in areas where there wasn't supposed to be anything. And one of them, is, about the size of Manhattan. No, I don't mean skyscrapers and all of that, but I do mean in area, in physical area.
Square miles or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and it's estimated that there are some 25,000 buildings in that region. So, you know, when you hear stuff like this, you say to yourself, "Well, my God, you know, that represents a sizable metropolis even in that early period." And so the fact that they are totally abandoned and in areas inaccessible to modern man tells you that there have been great changes in the world between now and the period when they were occupied. I knew Gene very well, and he was a remarkable man. And it's interesting how his life was modified by finding these cities. I will go into that if we have time, but to answer your question, in one of the civilizations that he found the remnants of, it was a white race, and I know that from the skeletons that they did find, because in Gene's discovery there were bones. As a matter of fact, there were mummies. And in this one area on the cliffs behind a great lake, where apparently they had a city near a lake, they found a cave or a tunnel which opened it to a series of sarcophagi, and there were remains in there. But more importantly, there was a very large stelae about the size of a mattress, and it was just leaning up against the wall in this interior, as if it had been prepared maybe to cover over these sarcophagi eventually. And it was literally covered with hieroglyphs from top to bottom. And they were the same mysterious writing, or at least very similar to that which had been reported by Rasposo. And so Gene went back to this area several times. And in one of his later expeditions, he brought with him a kit. I've never used it, so I don't know exactly how it works, but apparently you cover over this rock with some kind of a cloth, like a canvas or something, that has been impregnated with this rubber material, like latex, and you press it into the surface and allow it to harden, and then you can peel it away, and you wind up with a latex mold of what the rock looked like, and then you can roll this up, and it's not terribly heavy, so it's it turns out to give you a thin imprint of the entire structure, which is probably an inch thick or 3/4 of an inch thick. And I actually got that back to the United States, and they brought it to the I forget the name of the actual institution, but it's operated by the Mormons, and they apparently have been doing research into the lineage of mankind for many years. And they have language experts at their facility, which are familiar with many, many different tongues, including those long since out of use. And I asked about the progress on the translation for several years and didn't hear very much back. And of course, now that Gene has passed away, I don't know what they've gotten involved with or what they've discovered. Mm-hmm. But his sons, he had two sons, are still very much interested and active in his research, and so I may yet eventually hear something.
Yeah. There, when you mentioned Brazil, I can't help but think of the Nazis that went there. You know, we hear the stories about Argentina, and though there is a record of certain Nazi, key Nazi figures, or SS figures, having been in Argentina, we also have these stories of, the Antarctica and, other parts of the country, and Paraguay and Brazil are two places. There seems to be a recurring connection here, and this is related to Egypt. I mean, we know that they've discovered hieroglyphics, and I'm not saying that this area in Brazil had pyramids, but you have the sarcophagi, which is something related to Egyptian archaeology, and you have other traditions, at least in terms of art or expressing ideas, memorializing them in stone. Do you think that there is a connection somehow to Egypt or one of the ancient lands?
Well, it's always been my contention that the so-called continent of Atlantis had something to do with South America. Perhaps it had colonies there, or at least outposts of some sort. Mm-hmm. And whatever destroyed Atlantis definitely rearranged South America. There's no two ways about that. So some of these ancient sites may very well have some kind of a linkage back to the Atlantean culture. Now, what's interesting about that, Plato described in his writings the city of Atlantis quite clearly. And he described it as, the only thing that was really mysterious was where it was located, but he described it as being a huge city built on a rock prominence of some sort, and it was ringed by several groups of circular canals, which were separated by large flat areas, and then off to one side from this city was a huge rectangular clearing, for lack of a better term, which served as the agricultural center for this city. And people have been searching for years to try to find anything anywhere on Earth that even remotely resembled this. Well, the interesting thing about it is that, I forget the name of the guy who wrote the book, but about 4 or 5 years ago, a book came out addressing this issue, and this fellow who was doing aerial surveys of eastern, southeastern Peru, came across an area which, from a higher altitude, looked remarkably rectangular. And it was enormous in its stature. And he remembered this thing about Plato, and so he just took it upon himself to start exploring this area. And he found remnants of canals, and he found remnants of stones, which also had writings on them. But more importantly, the stones that he found were worked by human beings, and exceedingly ancient. And so, even though he didn't find a city that was intact and, you know, obviously worthy of exploration, he found something that, for the first time, rings a bell in its description with another ancient writing. And that would have been, you know, Plato's description of Atlantis. So, and by the way, Jean Savoy also believed that there was a connection because, not necessarily with Atlantis, but in his case, he was looking for, the legendary area of Ophir, the rivers of Ophir, which, interestingly enough, were written about by, King Solomon. Solomon apparently got his wealth from a nation that was different from the Mideast, where he resided. And he referred to the area as the land of Ophir. And, Jean Savoy believed that the river that he described may have actually been the Amazon or one of its, tributaries. Mm-hmm. And that the land of Ophir was somewhere in South America.
Now, Jim, I have a quick question here. With all of these, certainly devoted archaeologists going to this general area looking for something that seems to be privileged information, and they get to these areas and they find basically that everything is gone. Did anyone come to the conclusion that any of these areas had been discovered and possibly intentionally obfuscated? You know, you can sort of coax certain plants to grow in a certain manner or direction. You know, like vines and, and the like. And so, just because the thing was so massive, maybe someone actually took the time to try to obfuscate it and hide it. Was there any indication from anyone's writing that that may have occurred? That these villages were, plundered in any fashion?
Well, some of them would definitely have been, could have been plundered. One of the things that Jean Savoy was looking for was Vilcabamba, which was the last, hideout of the Incas, in their, flight from the conquistadors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people think that Machu Picchu was the last, city of refuge for the Incas, but actually, Jean Savoy did find Vilcabamba later in his career. And, it was miles and miles away from Machu Picchu and in a totally different direction. I don't know too much about it because frankly, even today it hasn't been opened up, you know, for general, view like Machu Picchu has. But there are archaeologists in there digging around now, at least, as a result of Gene's efforts. But there's not very much left in any of these places, and it's not clear, apparently, whether they were plundered or whether they were abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
But Gene does tell a very interesting story regarding one of the largest known treasures, which actually was originally situated in Cusco. When the Spanish first reached Cusco, according to the legend, there was a Jesuit with them, who was acting as historian. And he described the interior of one of the temples that before it was destroyed in later, years by the conflict. Which is so extraordinary that the description has lasted for all these years unmarred. But he describes a vast interior where the pathway that leads through it is all paved in gold, and as you walk through, it's almost like you're going through a museum or a display of some sort. And modeled in gold and silver, as you go, were all various aspects of the culture that existed at that time. For instance, you would see literally herds of llama, all modeled in pure gold with rubies or other precious stones for their eyes, and entire trees and flowers and all sorts of vegetation modeled in gold and silver to give contrast to their leaves and stuff like that, and various animals other than the llama, and just all sorts of themes from everyday life in this one temple, and it's very vividly described. I mean, I've read it more than once. And it's estimated that the wealth in that one room alone would have been in the hundreds of, probably billions of dollars, just from the description of how much gold there was. And yet, once the Incas realized that the Spanish were avaricious for their gold and willing to kill for it, that entire interior disappeared. Almost overnight. And legends have it that there was an enormous mule train, or not mule train, but probably a llama train, that left Cusco, for an undisclosed destination, prior to the actual invasion of the conquistadors. And they figure that llama train was carrying the treasures from this one temple, or perhaps from several. And that has become known as the treasure of Cusco. And, it was actually tracked as far as, Sacsayhuaman, which is a fortress built by somebody pre-Inca,
And then the entire trail was obliterated. Mm-hmm. But people have been looking for that one treasure alone for several hundred years, and they've never found it. No. Now, when I was down there, I talked to the Quechuan Indians, and they are very hard to gain their trust also, but I am convinced of one thing. The indigenous peoples know more about the past of South America and the whereabouts of some of these artifacts than they're willing to disclose. I'm almost positive of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, is this El Dorado possibly that we're talking about in terms of that legend or?
Well, the thing about El Dorado, the way it's described, was that there were seven cities, closely clustered, but not in exactly the same area, mm-hmm. and that they were literally paved in gold and exhibiting so much wealth that it was beyond description. Now, that may be an exaggeration, because that's a lot of gold and silver to have a whole city built of it. But just imagining the wealth of this one Inca temple and then extrapolating that, you know, into seven different cities, they would only have to have one building that was adorned to that extent in order to make them extremely attractive to a treasure hunter. But frankly, I don't give a rip about the wealth. I'm much more interested in what does it all mean.
Yeah, of course. I hope you don't think I'm asking these questions because of the money, because that's just part of the banking system anyway, you know.
Oh, Don, don't tell me that. I know you're making a map, even as we speak.
Actually, I'm not. The map is already created. I'm just following. No. Just kidding, Jim. No.
Yeah, but anyway, you know, the amazing thing about it is that if places like this do exist, they are in some of the most ungodly territory left on this planet. People take South America for granted, but it is a huge area. And by modern standards, it's really only very sparsely populated. I mean, if you look at the major cities like Manaus and some of those others, they are located, you know, in little tiny clusters, usually accessible by rivers, and now, of course, by airports. But for all intents and purposes, the area around them is vacant. Nobody even knows what's in some of these regions. And people who have ventured in there are encountering hardships that are just off the scale. I mean, it's just unbelievable. For instance, there's no food to speak of unless you're willing to eat stuff that a goat would refuse. The insects are terribly venomous, and they come in endless quantities, especially mosquitoes and flies. And of course, their bites get infected very easily, because the whole area is very humid and laden with different types of mold and fungus. You have parasites in the water. Diseases are rampant, especially in the white settlements or the modern settlements. Alcoholism is an unbelievable stimulus for the degradation that's persisting. And then when you get out of these little settlements into the backwoods, the snakes are just unbelievable. There's thousands of species of snakes. Most of them are venomous. And some of the worst ones are only a few inches long. And then, of course, you go to the opposite extreme, where you have these anacondas that have been reported up to 80 feet long. Fawcett shot one like that. And they will eat a man. There's no question about it. And there's a lot of controversy about that, incidentally, because they say, well, we could see how everything could be swallowed, but he would never get past the shoulders. But in reality, when one of those babies attacks you and they wrap around you, the first thing they do is crush every bone in your body. So your shoulders are no longer an issue. Neither is anything else. You're just a meal inside a bag by the time they get done with you.
Well, I haven't been described that way in a while, so something to think about. Do you think that these civilizations may have been built in those areas just because of the natural protection, or could it be that that the protectors were added after the fact?
Well, I'm not so sure that anything was added by intent, but I'll tell you what my theory is. I think that the region that we now view as South America was probably in a completely different place at one time. And it was more likely in a very temperate zone above the equator. It didn't have all these stinking jungles and insects and all of the other things that you have to contend with now. But there was some type of a huge cataclysmic event which took place on the planet. And the skin of the Earth shifted. We've talked about these polar shifts in the past. It would only have to move a few degrees, maybe 10 or 15 degrees, to really drastically change things.
Mm-hmm.
If it was originally, let's say, in the latitude of Cuba, for instance, which is a very mild and interesting climate, it would only have to move a few degrees to be put, you know, in the area of the equator, and that would change it drastically in its own right. And then, if the raising of the mountains occurred during this period, now your winds and your sea currents would come into effect and bring vast changes to the weather systems, because one of the biggest things that promotes the growth of vegetation down there is the fact that you have torrential rains almost every day. And the air that's moist blowing in off the Atlantic hits those mountains, and it just stops right there and dumps its load of water. The temperature and the rainfall are going to be key elements in producing enormous growth of vegetation.
Yeah, with the amount of pillaging of the forests under the guise of progress, especially in the Amazonian regions, it's almost like that is really the cover story for why they're down there. And to find these places, they've got to remove the trees, so they're selling them, leading one to believe that all that's going on is the deforestation. And yet we have the anomalies of the ozone holes in that general area, and for over a number of years. You think there might be some connection as far as, you know, somebody's looking and they're trying to clear all this vegetation that you're describing?
Well, I've not been to those areas personally, you know, where they're clearing the vegetation, but one thing I can tell you, all of the reports that come in concerning the location of these various cities,
mm-hmm.
Put them in more mountainous areas than the flat plains where and the wooded areas which are being cleared. Now that mm-hmm. doesn't mean that there aren't other things down there, you know, yet to be found and may emerge as a result of this clearing that's going on. But it's my understanding that when they burn off an area like that, their ultimate goal is actually to plant stuff, you know, and engage in either cattle raising or agricultural pursuits or this or that. But if they do have a secondary agenda, from the little that I know about the area, they're looking in the wrong place.
I see. Well, they're certainly disrupting nature, because when you remove all that habitat, or the cover for the habitat, these animals are going to be forced to migrate to other areas, you know, particularly snakes. So I'm just visualizing what might be going on that we don't know about.
Oh, I'm with you on that. I'm sure there's plenty of things going on, but the ramifications of what's going on are to be feared for sure. The oxygen content in our atmosphere used to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 or even higher, maybe 28%, something like that. And now it's down to like 14 or 16%. And in some cities like L.A. and Hong Kong, it's even less. It's maybe 8%. And this has a real drastic effect on humanity because, first of all, the brain to function properly requires a much richer environment of oxygen than it's been given lately. And secondly, there are many, many new diseases appearing as a result of the fact that with reduced oxygen content in the air, we are now being invaded by unusual forms of anaerobic bacteria and fungi. These are microscopic creatures which don't like oxygen and are very happy to thrive in an oxygen-deprived environment. So by our own activities, we are changing our Earth and changing ourselves without realizing it.
Now, are the natives there in that area experiencing any negative consequences? Or are they somehow resistant to these changes because of their general mode of survival and
well,
their understanding?
Some of the natives, like the Jivaro, for instance, are very resistant to their areas being invaded. They just non-discriminately kill anybody that comes in there. And they're trying to preserve a way of life that they know and understand. But on the other hand, some of the areas which have been influenced by the activities of the church, missionaries, the rubber barons, so-called civilization, the same story happens to them that has happened to many other indigenous peoples in our lands. For instance, the Native American, the Eskimo, the Inuit, all of these people are very negatively affected by encroachment of the white race. Sexual depravities and sexually transmitted diseases become rampant. Alcoholism just becomes unbelievable. Total destruction of any cultural prominence that these people may have had, which could have been of great benefit to the understanding of our origins, are wiped out ruthlessly.
Now, if these people live, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent on the people, but I think that they may have something to do with what, you know, this whole theme that you're talking about. If they're basically disconnected from modern civilization, where are they getting this alcohol? Is this something that they have learned to make, or were they taught this, or are they getting it from outside?
Oh no, it's brought in. Like for instance, when people go in an area to explore for oil, or if they find oil, for instance, you know, what they do is they put up a couple of derricks and start the drilling process, and once they actually get the oil, then the next thing they have is a landing strip. And a little, company town grows up around it, and then there's, outposts of different kinds, stuff is flown in for supplies, And so mm-hmm. any of the local people that, you know, are in that region wind up being affected by this change. And, you know, they wind up buying or trading for alcohol and for metal goods. Metal is always a big thing for these folks. You know, when they get a hold of a machete or a knife that's actually made of steel, it's a treasure to them because they don't have any way of smelting materials or refining metals on their own. But so these little pockets of white activity have very big effects on the indigenous people that are surviving in those regions.
Now, is your general understanding, Jim, that they know the value of gold, or do they have a certain respect and let's say understanding of what it means to them that might be different from so-called civilization, the central banks, in other words?
Well, the Incas, to answer that question, the Incas valued gold, but they didn't, I don't think they valued it so much for its wealth aspect as they did for its malleability. Because gold can be worked by hammering and extruding and drawing and things like that, which they excelled in, and they were overtaken by its beauty. The same thing with silver. I mean, they used these things for adornment purposes and to express their revere for beauty in their temples and what have you. The concept of wealth or avarice was taught to them by the actions of the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so I think that they are aware of our interpretation of its value, but they don't look at it in the same way.
Yeah. So they would naturally be protective of it for that reason, not because of any application in the banking system or in terms of a currency of exchange.
No, I don't think so. The other thing is that if they are aware of a stash of gold or a rich mine or something of that sort, the other reason why they would probably keep it secret is because they don't want white people there. You know, they know what's going to happen if they find out about it. So it's more to protect what they have in terms of their survival as a culture and to leave their natural resources alone so they can use them for their own purposes rather than them being afraid that their wealth is going to be stolen, because I don't think they look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, did Jean Savoy have any of those experiences? I know we covered a lot, and I know he was into learning about the people and probably the cities. Did he mention or come across any of this in particular in relation to gold, let's say?
You know, it's a funny thing that you mentioned that. I don't recall him speaking about any gold that they discovered, although there may have been some. If there was some, it would have been small, you know, in its amount. He talked mostly about, actually one of the things he talked a lot about was the quality of their weaving. He said that, they had found, for instance, in Chachapoya, in the Chachapoyan civilization, remnants of cloth which were so densely woven that they can't even describe, they can't even figure out how it was done. And another thing that's interesting is that apparently in ancient times they knew how to grow cotton that was already colored so that they didn't use dyes. They actually produced red, white, blue, green, yellow strands of cotton so that the plant itself didn't have white cotton balls, but it actually had different color cotton. So there are hints of the fact that there was once a greater civilization with a lot of technical know-how, not only in building, like architectural talents, but also into the technological and even the biological sciences. And all of this is ignored by the authorities in the United States.
Well, they use that at the ballparks. They sell cotton candy. the colors you just described.
Yeah, I'm sure, but I wouldn't want to wear a shirt made out of that stuff. Last
or underwear.
Particularly not underwear, thank you.
Yeah,
one thing I will relate to you, which is fascinating, and Colonel Fossett was the one, was the source of this information. He had visited some really remote tribes, and he didn't seem to have the normal concerns for his life that generally are exhibited by white people going into these areas. He he had a different philosophy about dealing with the natives, and so they returned the attitude in favor, and for the most part, he was accepted and even given hospitality in these regions. But some of the most primitive tribes that he visited used to have these little sessions where they would sit around him, and since he couldn't speak their languages, he had brought with him a series of photographs showing what his civilization was like. And there were two things that the people couldn't comprehend. One of them was an ocean. They just couldn't comprehend that there was a body of water that large. And the other thing that they had no knowledge of was ice. So when they saw these sheets of ice and people walking on it or skating on it from these pictures, it was beyond their comprehension what that means. But what was really interesting was when they showed pictures of the cathedrals, for instance, or castles, you know, or big, you know, buildings of that sort, they always responded the same way. They said, oh, yes, we have those here. Just a ways to the north or just a ways to the east, you will find those things, you know, that used to be here from the ancient ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so, he spent 26 years in the wilderness down there doing various jobs for different governments. And that whole time, he was also interacting with the indigenous peoples and making notes. And the general outcome of this was that he was fairly certain that he knew where some of these larger cities were as a result of this. And on his last expedition, he took his son with him and his son's best college buddy. And unfortunately, they never returned. So we don't really know what they found or what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. What the anacondas would tell us if they could speak, right?
They would just probably burp.
Well, Jim, we're just about out of time here. Have you covered everything that you intended to cover?
To be honest with you, Don, I could talk about this subject for a week. You know, there's no problem with additional information. But if you find it of interest, we can always do another show on it, or we can just let it slide, whatever you wish.
Certainly, I would be interested, and I'm sure the listening audience would be too, to find out. Maybe we can look at some of this during the week, do a little bit of research, and see if there's not something that I can throw into the mix that might already be substantiated by the research that you've done.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that can be uncovered. The biggest problem is, it's just like the uncovering of any other kind of knowledge. It's one thing to have the theory, and it's another thing to have the proof. Now, when I'm building a machine, I can theorize how it should operate, and That's all very well and good, but I don't really know if my theory is correct or not until I build it and test it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same actually holds true for this type of exploration. We can generate all kinds of interesting theories and what have you, but until somebody actually has the nerve and the wherewithal to go down and check out these things, it's going to remain a theory.
Yeah.
So
I find it particularly interesting, Jim, that that there are several stories about, let's say, Peruvian gold that is being used in the international markets as collateral to borrow against. And I'm wondering if that might not be some of the gold that may have been moved, or maybe it's just intentionally being reported as such to cause us to be misdirected, in other words, in order to hide its real location, if these stories are even true.
I don't know of these stories of Peruvian gold being used in modern circumstances, but I can tell you one thing. The wealth that came out of Peru originally and wound up in the courts of Spain and other places is so staggering that it just defies description. It's got to be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And the thing that's amazing about it is that it, according to all the estimates that come down to us from that time period, it was a drop in the bucket. So somewhere there still exists an enormous amount of wealth, and whether or not there are secret efforts to locate it, I don't know. But here's the thing that's weird about that. If, in fact, there are endeavors of that sort, the question that comes to my mind is, you know, what is the purpose of it? Because if you go and rape these areas just for their gold and silver wealth, and then you bring that wealth into the modern civilization that we have, where fiat money is the medium of exchange, and you never see the wealth,
mm-hmm.
and it's deliberately arranged so that the paper money has no wealth, then what would be the purpose of the entire endeavor? You know, if gold is not part of the exchange medium, it mm-hmm. no longer represents wealth. So it's a very strange set of circumstances.
Yeah, or it's only in the secrecy of how it's being hoarded or how it's being used and for what purpose. And then we could do a week's worth of shows just on that.
Absolutely, because there are other purposes for gold,
mm-hmm.
and its related elements, which are far more valuable than using it for money. And that might be something we could do a whole show on right there.
Well, maybe we can pursue this, and I know you have more information, so. Let's try to cover both aspects next week, if you're up for that. I think it would be interesting.
Well, sure, I'm happy to do that, and that gives me a whole week to put together a goodie list that we can talk about.
Mm-hmm. And then we could obfuscate it a little bit, and throw in a couple mystery cities there, just to get the gold miners a little misdirected, right? Just to keep them busy, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's all kinds of activities going on down there. It's just a question of finding them. And, you know, some of the governments that control these areas are not that open with the American way of life either. So you never know what's happening right under our noses.
Yeah, well, I don't think they should be, to tell you the truth. It's their land, they have every right to protect it and be free from, you know, the madness that the rest of us are going through, for sure.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't blame them for feeling the way they feel about the intrusions, and there's probably something else behind that that makes them feel that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Your other remark about Nazis in South America is very interesting. There's a whole thing about a Nazi city that was built in the jungles down there also. So we can touch on a lot of things if you want to.
Okay. Well, Jim, we're out of time. I want to thank you for the whole month here that you have dedicated yourself, and all the rest of the weeks prior to that over the past year and, say, three quarters. And I look forward to many, many more shows with you along these lines. We get a lot of interesting email from folks about the topics that you've covered. And it seems like as soon as I get an email about a particular topic, you've already planned something that we're going to discuss. So you're in synchronicity with the listening audience. It's a good thing.
Well,
so I
like
want to thank
idea.
You.
Well, I'm happy to do it, Don, and let's continue the tradition as long as we can.
Okay, so we'll see you next week then. I'm going to say a good night on your behalf to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and our special guest, Jim Murray. And if you're interested in looking at some of Jim's earlier scientific inventions or application of his work, by all means, go to my website, directlightproductions.com. In the meantime, special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and Doug Newsom, and Don Newsom on the sound. And I'm hearing the music. I hope you're still hearing me. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Have a good weekend. And to the listening audience, peace, love, and light, and have a good night.